I'm here today with one of the longtime accessibility champions at Microsoft, Cynthia Shelley. So, Cynthia, do you want to tell us a little bit about what your role at Microsoft is?
I'd be glad to. So I'm working in the Accessibility Business Unit, which is a central corporate group dealing with accessibility, and I'm working on strategy around web accessibility and solving some of the big problems that exist in the web space to enable developers to be able to create accessible websites a lot more easily.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned the Accessible Business Unit, the Accessibility Business Unit. So, you know, I know, you know, some companies kind of treat accessibility as, you know, something they give lip service to and, you know, have some kind of bolt-on thing. So can you talk a little bit more about how important or, you know, does Microsoft take this really seriously?
So we treat accessibility as a key pillar in our development process. And we've got this central team that's really spending a lot of effort, has a fair bit of senior staff, a lot of experience working with all the teams at Microsoft to get a consistent story around all of our products.
Cool. So, you know, for some of the companies out there that, you know, may see this, you know, see accessibility as a tax or, you know, something that, you know, just kind of a burden on their process, can you talk about why Microsoft sees this as being so important?
So Microsoft is about developers. We always have been. We're about making a platform that people can build software on. And the web is no different. And we want to make sure that our developers can create products, their products that they're selling to their customers, can be accessible. And we see that as a competitive issue. It's something where we want developers to be able to create good, accessible software without a lot of effort.
Cool. So you know, just right off the bat then, it's kind of a competitive edge, you know, versus, you know, other platforms, perhaps.
Right. It's we don't see it as a tax at all. We see it as a way that we empower people, that we empower both end users who may have needs around accessibility and developers who want to serve those users and who want to serve a variety of enterprise and government customers who are required to have accessibility as part of their processes.
Okay, cool. So I know that, you know, you've had an impact on a lot of internal products, you know, in the past, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit further in this interview. But, you know, what's really your focus? You know, are you focused more internally or externally at this point with access?
At this point, I'm focused mostly externally. I'm dealing with a lot of standards organizations, and I'm dealing with a lot of developer outreach and helping people who are building using our tools to create accessible products. And I'm also doing incubation. As I mentioned earlier, I think that we're interested in solving some of the big problems that are part of the web ecosystem. It can be very difficult to make an accessible website, especially if you're building something complex. A long time ago, you had basic HTML websites, and you know, the links and the buttons and the forms and the picture of your dog, all of those things are fairly straightforward to make accessible. But when you start talking about a complex application that happens to be built in HTML and JavaScript, then you're dealing with a harder problem. And a lot of what you need to make an accessible application isn't built in that environment. So when we were building Windows 32 applications, the old Win32 API, what you might get from Visual Basic, those controls all have accessibility information built into them. If it's a button, it says it's a button. Yep. And there's a place to fill in the text of what the button will describe itself as. And if you're using tools, all of those things get put into the right place. And it may not be a perfect user experience for someone who needs to use assistive technology, but it pretty much works out of the box.
Right.
Well, that's not true when you're building a dynamic HTML application. Right. You don't have a toolbar that's all built for you already. You don't have even a drop menu. You don't have a lot of these things that have information built in. So developers are finding that, you know, they'll build something that looks like the Windows control or the general desktop control.
Right, but in a lot of cases they're faking it, you know, using things that aren't actually controls in the website and so on.
Exactly.
Cool.
And they're hand coding all the behavior themselves too. So they may end up, you know, menus, like if you look at something like the menu that's in Windows, those controls have years of testing and built-in functionality and built-in behaviors, and people know what to expect from them. Both general users and users who are using assistive technology know what to expect from them. When someone who works on a website recreates that control, they'll usually miss something.
Right. So, you know, you've mentioned that really with the rise of the DHTML and AJAX kind of, you know, metaphors for programming, people have kind of moved away from the standard control set in HTML. Are there any other, you know, big challenges that you see people running into when they're building these sites, or is that really the main issue today?
That's the main issue. The main issue is really about not having the tools built into the platform the way that most developers are used to.
Cool. So it seems like that's, you know, something of an opportunity for some of these toolkit vendors as well. You know, you mentioned that just as a company, we regard that as something that, as a platform provider, we can provide. You know, it seems like that's really something that, from the perspective of Ajax Libraries and, you know, other vendors should really be looking at building as well.
So libraries really ought to be best practice code in all cases, not just around accessibility, but you want your library to be the best tested, strongest, cleanest, fastest piece of your product, because it's going to get a lot of reuse. And that's true for accessibility as well. You want to make sure that if you're using a library, that it's got all of the accessibility functionality built into it, that it was designed with accessibility in mind, because it's difficult to tack on later, and that when you stick that control into your page, no matter how that control is made, when you stick that control into your page, that it's got the accessibility information you need.
Yeah. So, you know, for somebody out there building a new website or, you know, building some of their own Ajax controls, what are some of the best practices that they can follow to avoid some of these pitfalls of you know, just raw Ajax?
So the biggest one is to think about how the semantics of HTML map to what you're trying to do. So the easiest examples of that are that if you want something that looks and acts like a link, use an Ahref, use a real link.
Yeah.
But there are probably controls and behaviors that you want that are not part of that HTML set. And then think about what is the closest thing in HTML and how you can use HTML controls and build them up and put them together to get similar semantics. So a good example of that is menus. You think about what a menu is. And yes, there's a menu tag in HTML4, but it's deprecated and it doesn't act like a menu at all. If you think about what a menu is, it's a grouped list of actionable items. Maybe nested lists of actionable items.
Yep.
Okay, so what's an actionable item in HTML? There are basically two, link and button.
Link and button.
Link is much closer to what a menu looks like.
Yep.
And
plus link can be styled easier.
So link can be styled easier, exactly. Yep. And then there's grouping. Okay, so unordered list is a grouping. Those are easily nested. And if you make a menu out of lists, unordered lists of links, then you get a lot of functionality built in that's part of the link. You get the structure of the nested menus, which allows tools that are not using a visual UI, that are building a UI based on the structure of a document object model. Those tools can say, oh, this is a list. It's a second level list in a nested list. I'm on item number 3.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of information that isn't there if you have a stack of divs.
Yep.
Also, the actionable piece of it is very, very important. So the onClick method of a link, of an Ahref, has a lot of functionality that's built into the browser that sends events all the way out to the operating system so assistive technology can react to that. If you just put an onClick handler on a span or you're doing something from on mouse over, you don't have a lot of that built-in functionality, and it's a lot harder, sometimes impossible, to get it to work all the way through because the browser's kind of sandboxed.
Right. And a screen reader won't necessarily know that just some random span with a with an onClick event is supposed to be tied into the screen reader or whatever.
Exactly. And there's also screen readers and some other assistive technology build their own model of the page, and the keyboard interaction can be affected, and it can interfere with what you expect your page is doing. So even if you test your page just tabbing through things and it seems like it's working, some of the assistive technology will not be interoperable with that. And so you need to be very careful to use the simplest thing, the closest to HTML, and that's going to be on click on a link.
Yep.
And then the nesting of menus allows you to get some extra structure in there. HTML is a structural language, right? HTML was designed for marking up physics papers, not user interfaces.
Right.
So thinking about how to model a user interface in document structure. And then you can use CSS to make it look the way you want.
Right. And in fact, it sounds like what you're saying really is that, you know, if you use the plain old semantic HTML and, you know, stick as close as possible to the HTML semantics, you get better accessibility.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, the same argument has been made that you get better styling.
Exactly.
You know, you get better, you can do mashups and extract data from those pages more easily and so on.
Exactly.
Okay.
When you're talking about assistive technology, something like a screen reader has a lot of similarity to a screen scraper or something that's pulling data out to do a mashup. It needs that structure. It's the same, you know, the same things that work for search optimization work for these tools. They're built on the structure
point.
Of HTML.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned that, you know, one of the key examples of that is people making menus out of unordered lists today. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see a lot of the people that are, you know, a little more savvy about web standards are doing that more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of these styling libraries, there's websites out there that have, you know, all different CSS skins you can place in to create dynamic menus all from the same set of HTML.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing I find interesting about that is that a lot of this stuff was possible a long time ago and people weren't really doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what's changed? You know, why are people going and using technology that was available for years and, you know, now focusing on it, or at least the savvy people are?
The biggest change has been in the support of assistive technology. So in the 90s, screen readers didn't work with script. They didn't understand CSS. A lot of the things that we take for granted, and that were actually even fairly in common use at that point, weren't supported by assistive technology. So the guidance, if you were making an accessible website, was to turn all that stuff off, have a no script.
Yeah.
That's not necessary anymore because the assistive technology has advanced and most of it works with modern sites. Yeah. So then you start thinking about, okay, well, what does that tool need to build a different user interface? What it needs is semantics.
Yep.
And even if my whole site is built from script, that's okay. These tools can work with a live DOM. They just need the same semantics in the live DOM that we used to ask you to put in the view source.
Right. Yeah, so that raises the question about the AJAX libraries as well. You know, it seems like a lot of the AJAX libraries out there will, you know, kind of require you to lay things out in your DOM in a semantic manner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of forces people to use some, at least, you know, smatterings of semantic HTML. So are there any libraries out there that you feel, you know, do a better job than others, or, you know, just maybe give a rough assessment of where you see the state of the industry at this point?
It's really mixed. I can't really give a requirement or a endorsement to a particular library, but the general idea is to evaluate a library and look at it for semantics before you decide which library to use. Think about that in addition to, you know, what are the features it has and what's its performance and who else is using it. Also think about, what are the semantics? Use it, you know, use a tool like the Internet Explorer Dev Toolbar or Firebug or one of those tools to see the DOM that it's generating and think about, you know, are these semantics right? Is that really how I would build a menu as part of your evaluation process?
Okay, great. So, you know, we've talked a little bit then about, you know, if I'm a page author or you know, an AJAX library author, how I should think about writing the DOM stuff. So once I'm beyond the design and development phase, what are some best practices around testing? You know, do we recommend that everybody go buy a screen reader and, you know, try to become good with it and test it that way? Or, you know, what do we do?
There's a really steep learning curve on screen readers, and there are a lot of different kinds of assistive technology out there, and some of them are quite expensive.
Yeah.
So it's not really feasible to say that every website is going to test with every assistive technology.
Yeah.
The biggest things you can do, first, if you're building some innovative piece of user interface, test that in the prototype phase with assistive technology. And there are groups that can put you in touch with real users who have assistive technology. You can do some of that in beta and alpha testing, or even usability testing if you can recruit the right participants.
Yep.
Do that kind of prototyping before you move forward when you can still pick from three or four different designs. That's the place where testing with assistive technology makes the biggest difference. And then, once you're in development, once you've got most of your site working, the kind of testing that is the biggest bang for the buck for a typical user interface is to test that you've got the mapping to assistive technology working. And what I mean by that is not test with every piece of assistive technology, but look at the active accessibility interface or the whatever accessibility interface you're using on whatever platform you're testing to, to see if these things are showing up as links to see if they're showing up as buttons.
Basically scan the accessibility tree that's created and
exactly.
make sure it makes sense.
Exactly. I use a tool called Inspect32, which is part of the Active Accessibility SDK. Okay. It's a very old-fashioned tool. It looks like something from Win3.1. But basically, it just shows you what's in the Active Accessibility interface. So Internet Explorer maps from HTML tags to that interface in a read-only fashion. Yeah. And since it's read-only, there isn't really anything you can do to change those values, but you can check to see that they're right.
Right.
And I use that tool. It also has a feature where it'll highlight the keyboard focus with a big yellow rectangle.
Yeah.
So I turn on this big yellow rectangle and I tab through the page. And I make sure that I can tab to everything, that the order makes sense, that I'm not seeing any mystery tab stops, which without the yellow rectangle are easy to miss.
Yeah.
Things that are focusable but off-screen or zero size can be problematic. And I also use it to see if the interface is being populated correctly, if there are names which would map to things like alternative text or link text, and roles which are describing, is it a link, is it a button? I use that tool a lot. And that catches a lot of errors that would typically be caught by code examination.
Yeah.
Only it's much faster, and you can have people who don't know the code very well do it. That's one thing that I do. I also use some of the settings in Windows. I turn on high contrast mode.
Yep.
And you'll see a lot if you turn on high contrast mode. I use large fonts in the browser, both Zoom and the large fonts on the old View menu. Those behave differently, and you'll see different bugs with them. There'll be some overlap, but you'll see different bugs with them. Those are the big things that I do. And then I do code examination, but I do it against the live DOM using the IE Dev toolbar.
Yep.
And I'm testing using my brain, basically. I'm testing to see, does this semantic representation in the DOM makes sense. Even if it's not a perfect match, it doesn't say toolbar.
Right.
But it says unordered list of buttons, that's a toolbar.
Yep. Whereas
if it said div, 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 span,
right.
maybe not so much.
I think a lot of the semantic HTML best practices are, there's just a series of rules of thumb that people can kind of inspect the DOM and look
exactly.
at and say, lots of BRs and, lots of divs and spans is...
Exactly.
Problem.
Exactly. And then I also look for some really simple things. I look for alternative text.
Yep.
It's easy to forget to put alt text on an image. It's a big problem if you forget to put alt text on an image.
Yeah.
Screen readers will read the URL of the image. And this may not be true on everybody's site, but on the sites I've worked on, Microsoft URLs, they have GUIDs in them.
Yeah.
They're not pretty.
Yeah, especially if they stick it up on some Akamai or LimeWire.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So... Also, in the dev toolbar, there's a feature that shows all the alt text, and it shows bracket, no alt text bracket for anything that's missing, even for spacer graphics.
Yep.
So it's a really quick, easy way to find stuff. And I also use that tool to disable CSS. Now, I don't expect that your site works without CSS, and I don't expect that it works without script. I mean, some sites do, but that's not necessarily a requirement for accessibility. But it will tell you if the objects in your document object model are in a reasonable order.
Right.
Gives you some hints about the semantic. If you've got something that's big and black, that's probably a heading. Headings are important. If you've got ugly black bullets, it's probably an unordered list, and that's important. Links turn blue. Spans that have blue styling and on-click handlers don't turn blue. So it's a pretty quick, easy way to do it. I find that we find 85% of the bugs doing that kind of stuff. Again, assuming that if you've done something innovative in your UI, you've tested prototypes with real assistive technology, and real users who know how to use it. Again, it's hard to use a screen reader.
Yeah.
You'll get a lot of false positives and miss stuff if you don't know how to use it.
Yeah, and we've been showing the Victor Tarson. Yui did a video with Victor Tarson of Yahoo doing a screen reader. The way he uses it, extremely high speed, which is, not the way that, just I would use it. So, yeah.
And screen readers also have a lot of features that you may not know about. Like you can hit a two-button sequence and get a list of all the headings on the page or a list of all the links on the page. And you need to think about whether you want to optimize for those features.
Right. And this is something I've noticed with the web accessibility toolbar from the Australian university that, will show you just a list of links or just a list of headings, which is kind of interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah.
And so someone who's using a screen reader will use that information to navigate around because it's very difficult to scan a page with a screen reader. So basically they get a table of contents made out of headings.
Yep.
And turning off CSS will give you a really quick idea of what the structure of your site is like or the structure of your page is like. And one of the other things that it does is that screen readers, and this is true of other AT as well, but screen readers particularly read out loud in the order of the document object model. Yeah. So if you're using a lot of absolute positioning, it's very easy for things to get out of order and for that to become a hideous mess.
Yeah.
And turning off CSS will tell you about that. It'll tell you if your dialogue is popping up at the end of the page where someone who's using a screen reader isn't going to find it.
Yeah. All right. So I'll step back a little bit now and just ask, you know, put you on the spot and say, you know, from a Microsoft properties perspective, mm-hmm. are there any sites within Microsoft or, I guess, you know, websites or, you know, web-oriented things that you think do a particularly good job of accessibility?
So there are a couple. The first one I'm going to talk about is actually an authoring tool. So it's not one of our sites. It's something called Windows Live Writer, which is a blogging tool. It works against the blog API, and it works with Spaces, and it works with WordPress and a bunch of other blogging sites. And it's an end-user tool. One of the things that's nice about it is that it's designed with the idea of making it so end-users create accessible content without even knowing they're doing it. So the HTML that it outputs is semantic.
Yeah, and this is a really important point, I think, mm-hmm. that, you know, so often when we talk about accessibility, we're talking about can a person with, you know, visual disability or something use the tool, mm-hmm. you know, such as Word or something. But there's this whole, you know, loop that, you know, on the web, it was about anybody being able to participate in creating content.
Exactly.
And then once somebody creates that content, is that content accessible? And so often you'll see a vendor making a claim that, you know, our site is accessible, but then it creates, you know, it allows you to create pages that are completely inaccessible.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, yes. So you're saying with the Live Writer that, you know, the HTML that it produces is semantic as well.
The HTML that it produces is semantic, and it also has some features for doing things like adding tables and adding headings. And they designed the UI to make it so that those would be the natural choices. For example, there's a drop down on the main toolbar that says heading 1, heading 2, heading 3, down to 6, and normal, instead of saying bold 14 point.
Right.
Now, you can do font changes, but it's not the most obvious thing to do, so most users will use the semantics.
Yeah, the default choices, you know, and I think that's the other thing that we see with, you know, some products will claim to be able to produce accessible stuff, but it's a non-default mode. You've got to kind of go way out of your way and find some hidden setting to make it happen.
Exactly. And so this is really about not just having people who know they want to make accessible content and are willing to work for it do it, but have everybody create content that's at least mostly accessible. They also surface a place to input alternative text. It's on the same dialogue with the rest of the picture stuff.
Yeah.
So while you're changing the size of your picture, you may see a place to do that.
Yep.
Spaces did something similar. The Windows Live Spaces did something similar, where if you input a caption for a picture, that gets populated as the alt text. So it's in a place where users are likely to put that text in without even really realizing they're doing it for accessibility.
Oh, great. So any other examples of, you know, great features or, you know, great sites at Microsoft?
Another one I really like is Hotmail. Now, that's a hard problem. Making Hotmail, when you talk about making a program, making a piece of software in JavaScript and HTML, Hotmail is a prime example of that. That's a very complex user interface. And they've done a lot of work to make it so that everything in there is tabbable and the reading orders are reasonable and things get refreshed in a way that actually works with assistive technology. And, you know, they're not completely done yet, but they've really been doing a lot of work, and I'm impressed with how far they've been able to come on such a difficult, complex problem.
Okay, excellent. So, you know, I'd like to wrap it up with, you know, there's been all this great information here. I think, you know, this interview could probably serve as a starting point for somebody wanting to know the best practices about accessibility. But for people who are interested in learning more, you know, where would you tell them to look?
So I wrote a white paper a year or so ago that's available on MSDN, and I can give you the URL.
Okay, great. And
there's also a paper that I presented at a conference last year at the Web for All conference, which is put on, it's co-located with the W3C's annual conference.
Okay.
So there's a paper there as well.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you for your time.